Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Giant Conversations number 3. And this time, tiny bit different, because this time Tommy is at KubeCon and I am here with Zach. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Ali. Yes, they didn't send me to KubeCon, so you're stuck with me today. But we always have great conversations, hopefully a giant one. Good to be here today.
Yeah, exactly. That's the that's the entire idea, and I have the right person to talk about security. But we'll kick it off with a new jingle. We're still at the new jingle each and every time, this time from Marianne. I'll kick it off. Interesting one from Marianne, I have to admit, but I think we're getting there. It'll be interesting at the end to figure out what our coolest jingle was, and now we need a new one. So to any listener who wants to submit a jingle, please do. We want to keep our jingles game.
Yeah, I like that one. I think pretty soon Giant Swarm will be both a fashion company and an audio production company.
Yes, I think we're getting there. You know, we'll bring out and we'll have a new Spotify thing with like our own label and stuff, and we'll bring out music. I mean, we have several people making music. I'm still wondering if, like, next on site we just can bring more instruments or actually have the hotel or wherever we are like ship drum kits and stuff and have them there, and we can just make music. That would be wonderful. You know, giant album,
giant production,
giant album is. Giant productions. Lots of I see lots of companies on the horizon. But we start with the news, and we actually have a very nice one. KubeCon just started, and there's a press release from the CNCF that Flux gains new corporate support, and actually Giant Swarm is among them. So we have a quote in there from our own Puya, but you have lots of different people, GitLab and a lot of others, that have voiced their support, and Flux is now securely seated in the CNCF as a project with lots of different supporters. So that is very nice to see. Congratulations to Alexis that really pulled off a nice one here to keep Flux running. We are very happy about it.
Very cool. Well done.
Yeah. I have one, not Kubernetes one, that is in our show notes in giant letters, because Microsoft Teams announced that you can now switch accounts, because our customers are using Teams and then we need to log in into that team, and that never works. It's not out yet. We hope it will. We'll see. I don't fully buy it yet. It'll really work, because Teams is a hell to work with. But we'll see. And, that ties into the next one that Heather put in there. Are we watching the internet die? Because we always touched a bit on the AI side. And admittedly, it did get me thinking, because what at Citron in the article says that with generative AI, and due to that mostly being situated with bigger companies, we actually get more centralization because nobody else can keep up. And that's an interesting thought idea, because, I mean, who else can buy 100,000 NVIDIA H100s and so on and so forth? No, we'll have an AI Giant Swarm Friends event mid next month. And I actually talked to somebody that's building an AI company at the moment, who might be presenting a bit what's the hot new stuff in the AI world. And like at the moment, you can't like, they can't spend more money on OpenAI because they just don't have enough chips, and there are not enough graphic cards for everybody to use OpenAI. So we're just at a certain bottleneck still. And that bottleneck is being only done by the big ones, and nobody else can get any items. And that will be interesting. We might hit on AI on the security side. That's an interesting question. But I'll just go through the news. Google has a blog discussing their threat modeling when deploy post-quantum cryptographic algorithms. That's something actually internal. Puya said that big states, countries are already logging every data they can find somewhere that is encrypted, with the idea that a few years down the line, they will be able to decrypt it. because if they already saved it before it was re-encrypted with quantum safe computing stuff.
Absolutely.
So all our old secrets will be
and,
out.
And it isn't just nation states. For example, you know, LastPass had that breach last year or the year before at this point. And that's also a concern for businesses, because even if an encrypted vault is leaked at some point, if quantum computing becomes commoditized, then also cyber criminals will be able to use it to decrypt things that have been encrypted and are safe only for now. So it's not just a nation state you have to worry about in that case.
Yeah, it's just my only question is always, how interesting is 2-year-old data or 3 or 5-year-old data?
Can be very interesting, though. For example, in the case of something like a password manager vault, how often do you think all of the credentials in that vault are rotated?
Mm-hmm. I see that I'm talking to a security guy, so we're touching upon different subjects. Let's see once we continue. Parker open source infrastructure by continuous profiling. Actually, polar signals, we know those actually have a very nice kudos coming out from Vercel, which is a huge company. They really managed to save a lot of costs based on the open source profiling Polar Signals does. But talking to a few other people, there's stuff from Grafana Labs that is in the same direction. So there's lots of different people going there, and we actually have different projects with customers to like save costs. And there are some easier things and some harder things, and you need to work with teams. So it's like, it's nice that you have a tool, but as with many tools that we might touch upon later, the tool alone doesn't help. And I presume the same thing.
Yeah, very much so. We do have the capability to use Pyroscope within our managed infrastructure now. But as you said, to get full utility of that tool, you do have to change some workloads. So it requires a bit of a application change.
You need to do stuff. Yeah. Down the AI rabbit hole, Acorn Labs, for those that remember, actually founded by Darren Shepard, was doing something new in the entire Kubernetes space, because he's the guy that came from Rancher that sold to SUSE, and they're now shutting all that down and are just focusing on GPT script, some AI scripting language. I'm not sure if it's really because of a business case or just raising money for anything that has AI attached to it is just way easier. So that's the skeptical entrepreneur me about like people liking raising money and stuff. So I don't know. We'll see what comes out of it. But at least it's good that they found something. But in terms of the raising, what totally confused me is that HashiCorp actually is looking for a buyer. It again goes down the same, like one of these open source tool things is looking for a buyer. They're actually making a loss. So net loss of like 10 million a quarter, but they have 1.2 billion in the bank. I have no clue. They're worth 5 billion. They have 1.2 in the bank. They're making 800 million in revenue. I don't fully understand why they're looking for a buyer. Anybody with more information, gladly reach out. We can also do a this is off the record. Just say at the beginning of your email, Oliver at GiantSwarm.io, off the record. Just explain it to me and I will never say where I heard it from. Before we go into the KubeCon bit, the security bit, so Swarmies actually are at KubeCon, 21 people strong, have descended upon Paris, have infiltrated Rejects, and are now setting up the booth for start of KubeCon tomorrow. Our own Marco Ebert will be talking about Ingress, Nginx, and the 2024 plans. That's one. And we have a press release out, actually, about our Giant Swarm Platform 3.0. There was lots of discussion. Is it 2.0, 3.0? What kind of zero is it? And so on and so forth. But it's our full change to cluster API for the entire platform. So we had... historical lesson, like we had non-Kubernetes stuff first, and then we had Kubernetes operators, and now we're moving to cluster API after watching cluster API closely for many, many years. And now just saying it's ready. So there's lots of commits from our end and additions to Cluster API from our end to help the project further. So that was a really good time now. And we already have lots of stuff running on the 3.0 platform, which can include VMware and Azure and AWS and also cross-provider. So we have factories attached where we have Azure management clusters and workload clusters in Azure, but also workload clusters in different factories on VMware. So there is lots of interesting stuff. Please read and delve down into what that really all means. Links are in the show notes. And that, my friends, brings me to why Zach is here. Because I wanted to, like, whenever the idea of the podcast came up, I said we need to talk about security because I think we actually did lots of interesting things and we have somebody with Zach that can actually talk. I don't actually know how Zach does it, but I always find it fascinating that you're so calm but still convincing. You can tell people that you actually have no clue and it's a stupid idea and here's what the right idea would be and they will start nodding. And don't feel offended. So congratulations for that miraculous thing that you do. So we'll kick it off with a general idea, like maybe a bit of background. How long have you been doing security, or like what got you interested in security as such?
Excellent question, and I don't know that I have an answer for that. Off to a solid start with Zach not knowing the answer to things. I don't know. I guess it just kind of happened organically. My first few roles in technology were all security focused, and it turns out I kind of enjoy doing that. So I've just continued, and now Giant Swarm has stuck with me, and now I enjoy bothering our teams for all kinds of reasons, and hopefully we all have some benefit from that.
We're all very happily stuck. So let's go to Kubernetes, because like we've been doing that for years. We always put security high on our list, running critical workloads, having gone through auditing of like gigantic companies like Deutsche Telekom and Adidas and so on and so forth. So this security has always been important. We ran proprietary tools that we don't like not being able to look at the source code and figure out how things exactly work and potentially even being able to fix it. And some years back, we started working on our own security solution, fully open source driven, that all our customers have or can have in their clusters. So why in your mind is security in Kubernetes slightly different or the same than another security approach that people might take?
Yeah, well, you know, we work with lots of organizations, especially as they are the organizations we work with are in various phases of their Kubernetes adoption when we work with them. And the good news, as I like to tell their security practitioners and their security leadership, is that security hasn't really changed also in a Kubernetes world. What has changed are kind of the abstractions or the methodologies that we use to work with fundamental security concepts, but the security itself as a practice has not really changed. For practitioners, I like to frame the problem as that a container at the end of the day is a process on a machine, and that process has several layers of fancy new clothes that we use to deal with it in a Kubernetes world. So for example, the process plus some metadata, that's your container. A container plus some more metadata, and that's a pod. A machine plus a kubelet is a node. And Kubernetes just provides us a set of abstractions for dealing with things that are already very familiar. In a lot of ways, what's old is new again. You know, we're worried about things like role-based access control, and that needs to be translated into Kubernetes RBAC. We're worried about things like network reachability and firewalling, and that needs to be translated into network policies or Cilium network policies, as the case may be now. We're worried about preventing mistakes and accidental misconfigurations. Those are things that in the Kubernetes world translate into PSPs or PSS as the case is now, and enforcing best practices through admission controllers and things like that. But those as security concepts have not really changed. And we just use kind of new tooling, new methodologies for dealing with those things like immutability and declarative abstractions and immutable infrastructure. So GitOps is a big one now, where instead of having maybe some tool-based or database-based abstraction for dealing with security workflows, you work in Git. And so you declare what the state should be in Git, and that gets rolled out and enforced in clusters through kind of a more native mechanism. That's a bit of a change. It also introduces...
But is it like... I think it is to a certain extent, but the question is, will that change and evolve? Because like with my layman's terms, if you think about it previously, and I remember that actually from like early customer conversations, like, we by now have implemented a firewall between each and every machine, and we as security provide the rules. And now it's in Kubernetes, and their firewall is out because it's outside of the cluster. Suddenly those security people need to work inside of the cluster, which they never had before, and potentially look at GitOps and potentially need to do something, potentially work with teams. And that makes it a very different way of working, which from my experience is actually the hard one. Because yes, the tool, like, or the concept is the same. You know, you make sure who can talk to whom and so on and so forth. But enforcing that and them, it's no longer the case that security has a certain tool chain and they watch over that and they make things secure through that and the developers do whatever they do. They kind of need to work together more, don't they?
Yeah, that's very true. And then my advice to practitioners is, if you're a security practitioner, is to get CKA, for example. CKS is a good one as well. And because to work in a Kubernetes environment, you're going to have to understand those abstractions. And the best way to do that is to get hands-on with Kubernetes itself. Also, reusing the tooling and the processes that still work is a good way to achieve kind of faster adoption of your environments, assuming that you're still in the process of adopting Kubernetes. And my advice to kind of security or business leadership is to allow time and have the expectation that practitioners are going to have to adapt to the Kubernetes environment.
But you always say practitioners. That's already an interesting question. Do we need to move we have a security department and an engineering department to a, we have like a security oversight, whatever department, and these practitioners that kind of partly are in teams and work more closely with teams. Does there need to be more interaction now thanks to Kubernetes because it's all so intertwined?
I think that's always been the case, that there are always benefits of having more interaction and shared understanding between kind of security and engineering or security and development. That has always been the case. Realistically, some of those behaviors are different. It's still two distinct roles between mm-hmm. security and engineering. However, there are lots of opportunities now for, you know, we talk about shifting left. There are lots of opportunities to move security, at least some elements of especially application security, more into the control of a developer. It is absolutely the case that security will have to understand Kubernetes environments and also that they will have to have a good working interface with their developers. And that involves both a, depending on your organizational structure, your security team, your platform team, if that exists, and your developers. Those three are all kind of stakeholders here.
Mm-hmm. Because I remember talking to one customer also, it's like some of the older stuff they secured, I don't know, a Windows machine operating system is up to date. We seem to be going down way deeper into security stuff in the Kubernetes world with scanning each and every library that is in there that you might not even be looking at in other, especially closed source applications. Well, which kind of leads to this CVE bloat, I'd say, that you have hundreds of CVEs open that you probably most of the time shouldn't even care about, but they're just there and you need to kind of deal with it and it needs new models of interacting.
Yeah, that's true.
I actually, I had a meeting with, mentioning companies, with Wiz today, and they kind of have something that we have also talked about from time to time, in the sense that they're scanning from the outside, but looking at a lot of different things on the different machines and network traffic and so on and so forth, and saying, okay, this is a CVE that is on a machine that has that port open and that has that thing unsecured, and these other three things together lead to it being exploitable, and it's connected to a database that actually has personal user data, and hence you should take a look at it. Because often it seems like, okay, you might be an exploit. Somebody from a customer recently gave me the example where like AWS tells you this machine you just started has fiber channel and there's a bug in fiber channel and hence you need to update that machine. And then I don't have fiber channel on and the bug that is there is only for port X and port X is closed. So I might have that machine, but other than that, it's meaningless.
Yeah.
So
you're touching on kind of a recent issue in security circles as well about whether and the degree to which CVEs are a useful estimation of risk at all. And it's very much the case that, okay, I actually wanted to cover this in a different section, but it's very much the case that CVEs are one of the, I would argue, flawed heuristics that companies reach for when they set out to design a security program. And I say it's flawed for several reasons, but as you mentioned, the presence and the severity of an individual CVE is not a good indicator of the risk posed to an organization, partially for the reasons you mentioned. One is that code actually reachable, and is the reachable code exploitable in its usage in this application? Another is that, so first of all, the CVEs are very context dependent. Another is that because CVEs have had such wide adoption, because they are structured in a way that's, you know, machine digestible, and we can scan for them, they have become kind of the de facto source of information about vulnerabilities in software, which has led to increased attention from the security community in creating CVEs. You know, now if you want to prove yourself as a hacker, you try and go get some CVEs to your name, regardless of the impact, right? So it has become kind of this circular problem where the more the industry relies on CVEs, the more incentivized researchers and also other types of tooling are to use CVEs, which kind of perpetuates this problem. So maybe you have a CVE in a library that is not reachable in code, but it's, as you mentioned, very difficult, especially using purely open source tools, as we experience, it's very difficult to map that CVE to any real risk in an automated way. Mm-hmm. And so businesses that try and do that do tend to struggle in prioritization, just because there are going to be thousands of CVEs in your environment and you can't possibly have your developers look at all of them individually.
Mm-hmm. But okay. It's interesting that you say that, but yeah, it sounds so true that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The more people pay attention, the more people will figure out, like, can we push something in there? It's all automated. So if they find something, like if I find a CVE, I know my name will be in that and so on and so forth. I found it and it will be distributed to thousands and thousands of companies where potentially interesting people will take a look at it. Like I recently learned about a company that does security trainings for people. What they actually do is they send phishing emails to companies. And then a week later, they send the security person a mail. We sent 1,000 phishing emails to your company and 100 people clicked the links and would have had an exploit on their computer. Mm-hmm. Do you want a training? And it's like, yes, I'd like to have a training. That's maybe overdoing it a bit, but I get the idea. But like one of the questions we had written down, and I know I'm jumping back and forth, Zach, but I'm just, that's how my brain works. So something we always seem to have a problem with, that security thinks different, and security leadership, and they would like to have a dashboard, and they would like to have an overview, but they can't really influence the developers. Why is that all still so hard? Why is it all still so hard to figure out how to make stuff really secure?
I'd say those are different questions. But to touch on the first one, I alluded to this earlier, that security and development are different jobs. And even though I fully support moving many security concerns under the purview of the application owners, or the developers, as the case may be, I do think that they are different roles. And that is partially why it's so difficult to find tooling that works for all parties. And I say all parties, and that can mean different groups of parties in different organizations. So, for example, in a typical enterprise that we work with, you might have developers as a stakeholder and management as a stakeholder and security as a stakeholder and the platform team as a stakeholder. And if you have a governance, you know, GRC team, they might have even more different priorities for that tool. And it's really hard to land on one tool that does that for all those parties well. And it's also hard to find one tool that does that in a way that supports those workflows across different types of infrastructure.
So do you think we need several tools at the end, at best?
Do
we need to have the right tool for the right job and need to make sure that we have APIs? And does it need to be a microservices security environment, in my language?
I very much think that we see too often people come to us and say, which tool should I buy? And the question that they should be asking is, what is the workflow that I want the tool to support? So, and that's going to be different based on the company, right? Not every company is VC-backed. Not every organization is a large enterprise. There are a range of factors here. And for some organizations, we run purely open source, a purely open source tool stack. We have the luxury of being able to do that because we have a team that we dedicate to managing those applications and managing the platform. And so we can get away with that. But other companies, especially smaller ones, may not have the resources to dedicate to managing all of those things individually. And so for some of them, maybe the right answer is buying kind of an all-in-one, especially if you have a very small footprint. You only run on, one cloud provider, and you only run particular environments, and all that's covered by some tooling. You're probably going to pay through the nose for it. But that's...
That's always my question, because when I talk to people, it's like, okay, you'll pay per node and per developer. And so obviously it's in their interest to make it into a tool that every developer should use and not only the security department. And that should be on every node. Then you have, like, it needs to be on every pod or container or I don't know. Escalates quickly.
I think you and I could probably talk for the entire hour about some of the problems with commercial tooling that we've experienced over the years. As you mentioned, paying per node sets very much the wrong financial incentive. So then we're going to run everything on one large node, so we only pay for one license, right? You pay per user seat. Okay, great. Good. Then either none of our developers can use the tool, it's only a security team tool, or, like you said, we're going to pay for every single developer to have a seat. Some tools also charge by the number of metrics, or the size of the metrics, or the size of the data. Mm-hmm. That's good. So we have a security tool that sets an incentive for us to use the tool less, right? These are all really problematic models in my mind. But to be honest, I don't know the right way. I haven't landed on the right way to do it. I would actually be really curious, what do you think, me being the security mind, you being the business mind, what's the right way? How should we be pricing security tools?
Well, I can fully understand why security tools are priced that way, because it's an easy metric to tell people. On the other hand, I often like to think, but that's the open source mindset. Like, we have one product and we build that one product, and theoretically people need to pay for us being able to build that product. And yes, there's also a certain connection because we manage things, that the bigger your infrastructure is, the more different your management clusters are, like one on-premise, one AWS, and so on and so forth, maybe AWS China or whatnot. Like there's a price influence. And I'd like to build a thing that mimics that price influence. And I don't necessarily, if they don't run the tool for the company, then I don't fully see why data is something. If they run the tool in the cloud, then it's storage. Yeah, fine. But that would, the company shouldn't care because it's, you're pretty much paying for storage as storage is paid for. And they could say that's just, you're just paying for usage. I'd like actually people to use it. So I think the idea of paying per developer is a stupid idea, because the more you have people use it, the more valuable the tool gets. And then the question is, like, do you charge for training? Do you charge for, like, how much interaction you have with people helping and so on and so forth? Do you have, like, how secure the workload is? But that's hard to quantify. Theoretically, I'd love it to see that they say, okay, like, we show you that you only need to work on 1% of your CVEs. And that's actually expensive, because that's work. Question is how to quantify that. Mm-hmm. But I want it to be used, but that's a long-term thing. And that's what we're also trying to say, like, it's one platform. Please use everything. Because long-term, that creates the most value, and that's the most interesting for the customer, and you have a long-term relationship. But Giant Swarm is now almost 10 years old. That is weird for a startup. We're very, very long-term focused. So that might be different. But I don't have a solution either, Zach. And like, if we could find a solution now in here, that would be interesting, but I highly doubt it. But I mean, at the end, they can always sell more stuff. Like you put supply chain security. Actually, that was a buzzword last year, kind of. It kind of stopped being a buzzword, didn't it?
Funny how that works.
But what is supply chain security above that? And why is it important? Because we touched on CVEs, like anomalies, I don't know what, but what is a supply chain security?
Yeah, well, I thought it'd be interesting to mention, specifically because it had so much attention last year. You know, we had kind of blockchain and supply chain security, and now, you know, AI. And supply chain security, maybe controversial opinion, but is not different from security generally. It's just a new framing, I guess, for... at least for those running Kubernetes, they're not already doing this. Once again, not every company is SolarWinds, right? And I feel like the kind of wind in this...
Why SolarWinds?
Because it came to international, or I don't know, media attention after SolarWinds was compromised through a supply chain attack, and because SolarWinds was used by a bunch of government institutions around the world, it became this...
Okay, but what was the supply chain hack? Just so we get an idea what was specifically supply chain about the hack?
Well, the whole idea behind supply chain security is that because software is composed of other software, part of securing that software is to secure any vendors that you use along the process of actually building your software. Any dependencies that you use in your software need to also be secure, and you need to have a process and some kind of way of guaranteeing the provenance of those artifacts. And so the concept of supply chain security takes these concepts, which have already existed in the security space, things like dependency analysis. There's still some scanning involved there. Things like more GRC topics, like, are you working with vendors that have good security practices, things like that. And so,
is the entire SBOM, KBOM kind of, is that playing a role there? Then they're just knowing what kind of software you have. I'm very happy. SBOM, by the way, stands for Software Bill of Materials, a term I learned recently.
Yes, exactly. So, as part of this push for supply chain security, one of the, in my opinion, useful outputs of it is these SBOMs, these Software Bills of Material, that are basically a list of the various components that go into your software. So if you build this application, it would include the basically a list of all of the different libraries that you mm-hmm. include in your application, right? KBOM, the Kubernetes Bill of Materials, is a similar structure for the components that belong in a Kubernetes cluster. So you might have an SBOM for mm-hmm. the Kubernetes API server. You do have that. Now you can have a KBOM that's a lists all of the components like the kubelet versions and the API server version and the scheduler and all that kind of stuff that belong to a okay. Kubernetes cluster so that it's easier to reason about what vulnerabilities or what risk might be present from
to a those. Certain extent it's like our release versions where we just say okay, Giant Swarm release 19.3 includes these all these things,
yeah,
and that's the exact version
exactly. It's just a structured way to do that, and I would add that producing those things, if they are consumed somewhere, is a useful exercise, making them available.
If they are consumed somewhere, something we also learned, it's very easy to produce, not very easy to get used.
Exactly. And depending on, basically, this is why I think we are not talking about supply chain security as much as we were last year. When it comes down to it, it's one thing to sign your images. It's another thing to impose some rule about which dependencies you can use and require developers to make those changes. Supply chain security is about, you know, shifting security left into your build pipeline and securing the build pipeline. Well, if you have to make changes to the build pipeline or you have to change developer behaviors, that can be very difficult and a slow process. So that's why I think we haven't seen as much discussion of it. Mm-hmm. Not to say that the ends are not still, you know, a worthy goal to sign your images and produce an SBOM and have these attestations for other types of security processes. But that's why I think mm-hmm. We don't hear about it as much, is because the actual implementation of supply chain security can be difficult for organizations.
Mm. Because we're already, like, theoretically, we're already over time here, but I knew this would happen. So, but I still have questions. One thing I had in my list of questions, and I'm not even sure I want to talk about it. And by now I have two distinctly different questions. And A, no, that's B. We start with A. Where should somebody in Kubernetes security start with if they say, okay, we need to increase our Kubernetes security? What should they start? Like, what's the first step? And then on the other end of the spectrum, what is the fun, shiny new thing that is currently like all the rage that might be the next thing for those that like also where, how I always say, like if we run your clusters and we run that platform, the normal things is taken care of and you can look at the shiny thing and you can actually work with our security team, with you and others, to really think about that new shiny thing. So first, what's the low-hanging fruit, what's the first step and what's the new shiny thing?
I'm going to do that annoying security person thing where I say it depends.
Oh.
But in general, if they are my clusters and sometimes...
Oh, that I will always use. I don't care if it depends, just in general. Very good. Yeah. That is my answer to it depends now.
I will do both. I will say it depends and also give you a real answer. two things. The first is for practitioners or for platform teams. In my opinion, locking down and constraining individual pods through formerly pod security policies, now pod security standards, that should be a very early goal for a Kubernetes cluster, because...
And it's not used a lot. Like, we recently found statistics that it's actually not that many people that have used PSPs.
Yeah, it was actually also a Wiz paper that they put out about moving from PSP to PSS, and... According to their data, less than 25% of the clusters that they scanned on Kubernetes 1.24 were using PSPs. And
okay. That's not a lot.
That's not a lot. Those are rookie numbers. We gotta pump those numbers up. I will say, so that, in my opinion, makes a big difference, because most of the security incidents that we have been involved in with customers have been related to compromise of a workload. It's far more likely that a workload is going to become compromised than the control plane itself. And constraining what that workload can do within the cluster prevents lateral movement from, you know, or escalation from, so, you have one application that gets owned to you have a cluster that has been owned.
So what, give me an example of a PSS. What does a PSS prevent when you programmatically say something can't happen?
Well, going back to, I said the only difference with KDS security is abstractions. There's this pod abstraction, and the pod security policy, or now the pod security standards, targets certain fields on that pod that say, for example, you cannot run as root, or you cannot run in privileged mode, or you cannot run with certain capabilities assigned to that process. Remember that at the end of the day, we have a process on a machine, and the pod is how we instruct the kubelet and the container runtime to set up that process. So the pod security standard says you cannot set up a process on a machine that is running as root, for example.
Or writing on disk. Or
exactly. Or you cannot mount, you know, sensitive paths on your underlying host node.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so preventing workloads from doing that is a great way to kind of keep them contained. In theory, if you have a well-hardened pod, then the risk to the cluster would rely on a container escape, like some kind of zero day or a vulnerability in the container runtime.
Okay.
Among other potential vectors, but in theory.
Okay, but shiny new thing. So we have so RBAC we already mentioned, and like securing, like who can do stuff, and PSS, fine. Shiny new thing.
The shiny new thing. We have learned quite a bit from this PSP to PSS transition process, and one of those is that anytime we have to have all of our customers go and touch workloads, that is incredibly painful for us and for them. And also that if we do that, we actually have pretty good results from it. So looking at kind of the initial monitoring from our PSP to PSS transition, it depends on the customer, but we've had 50 to 90% improvements in the actual security posture of our customers' clusters by moving them off of PSPs and into PSS the way Giant Swarm has designed it. And we want to continue doing that. So the shiny new thing is something we're calling Policy API. And the Policy API, it's a Giant Swarm specific thing. We have kind of two goals in mind. One is the Giant Swarm goal of being able to manage our customers' clusters during these transitional periods. So in the future, if we want to kind of change the wheels while the car is moving, we can do that without having to have as much customer disruption for their developers. Mm-hmm. But also we can impose new security standards and requirements without inconveniencing or disrupting running workloads. So we have this this new abstraction specific to Giant Swarm where our customers can declare an intent to enforce some policy. And we have this platform feature that will orchestrate the tools that we use to enforce that policy. So under the hood right now, we use Kiverno for pod security standards. Our customers do not need to write or manage Kiverno policies in order to enforce those PSS standard, those pod security standards and their clusters anymore. We take care of configuring Kiverno. They just tell us they want them enforced. Same thing going forward in the future. We have other tools that are part of our platform already that customers are using and managing themselves, like Falco for anomaly detection and Trivi and Trivi Operator for vulnerability management. Those are already used by customers and they get value out of those things. But we often hear that they don't want to become an expert in Falco or become an expert in Trivi in order to use them. So we will also bring those underneath our Policy API and manage those tools for customers.
Is that also the thing you recently mentioned, that where we could potentially in the future say, like, okay, we can now turn that security item on, but it'll only work on new or changed workloads, so we don't like destroy the entire cluster or have to wait for everybody to update, but kind of everything that is there is fine. Everything that gets a new version gets deployed and you need to adhere to the policy, but the old stuff doesn't die. Because it's like that, from me handling customers, always like, okay, we now need to make sure that everybody moves to X, and before that, we can't upgrade something else.
Exactly. That's the first feature we're building because we think it's going to be one of the most impactful. We have this kind of a from now on. We have this from now on feature where it'll be really nice for us as Giant Swarm as well, because now we can add new policies. We can enforce new restrictions without interrupting workloads. But customers can also say, you know what, from now on, maybe in the old days, you know, we weren't quite where we needed to be on running as root, but from now on, no more running as root. If you give me a new workload, it can't be root. We're working on ways to enforce that also in CI pipelines so that, you know, we do actually kind of shift left and give developers an opportunity to fix things before they deploy. But you as the organization will be able to say, I have this new policy. I want to roll this policy out, and the platform will take care of applying it only to new things,
new
and
stuff,
not disrupting what's already there.
Very nice. I think we could theoretically go on for ages, which was my, like, I love talking to Zach. But we need to, I still theoretically have lots of different questions on the list. But I think we'll have to slowly call it a day, unless you have something else that you desperately want to add, or if you can save it, we'll do another one in a few weeks and delve deeper into certain subjects. Do you have something else which you desperately want to add?
I don't think so. My parting words would only be to security practitioners, frame your activities as enabling your customers to accomplish their mission. And if you are a security business or a security leader, be honest with yourself about your needs and capabilities and design the workflow first rather than the tool.
Oh, Zach, so wonderful. That's so quotable. Great. And with that, please, people, before I go to our bug of the week, which people seem to like, so we have another bug of the week, which I needed to promise Zach that he doesn't need to know the bug of the week when I explain it. And I got confirmed that I can explain it, so we're good again. If you have any questions around security, and we're doing another one on security, I'm sure of it, please send them our way. You'll be able to reach us any way you want. You'll manage. And ask us a few questions. We can obviously, as a customer, just reach out to Zach in Slack and ask your question directly, but gladly also to me so I can learn something. And then we can do another one delving a bit deeper, because I think we covered a lot of ground and I really like it. And we have some good learnings. So that's great. And with that, first, already here, thank you, Zach, but we'll say goodbye in a bit. I just need to scroll down here in my notes. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Bug of the week. We need an extra jingle for the bug of the week. Somebody, give me a button I can press.
Some kind of splattering sound.
Yeah, splattering. That is a bug of the week. Obviously, this year is more, and even last year is more, in the cost-saving realm than the innovation realm. So we worked a lot with customers on cost savings, also with Carpenter. We noticed that we are reaching Cilium API limits due to Carpenter evicting pods, like Carpenter two things. Like, see, theoretically, Carpenter can use spot instances. What Carpenter also can do is making sure it packs clusters more densely, so it figures out if I move this around here and this around here, then suddenly everything is more filled. So you need less machines, so that's good. But like, we need to raise those limits. And then our own Pavel kind of figured it out by looking deeply at it. And he actually raised an upstream issue that is linked in the show notes just like 2 hours ago. So the thing is that it seems that network policy objects with CIDRs are the culprit. Without network policies, everything is fine. Then he tried out with 500 network policy objects that created with 10 different random CIDRs in them. Node local identities went up to 70K, causing timeouts. And then pods get stuck in container creating and so on and so forth. And that is especially true for single IP networks. And I quote, Cilium creates 31 secondary labels for single IPs to just be sure that it has all those network policies figured out. Already, first thing is packing single IP CIDRs into slightly bigger subnets will help, because that highly decreases the number of labels you have, and Cilium doesn't end up complaining. And for those that think I butchered it, or those that want to learn more, read the upstream issue. That's along the, this, it has graphs in it and stuff, you know, lots more than I can explain, but the links are there for you to follow. And with that, 20 minutes longer than normally, these interview things will be fun. So I'm very sorry for those, but everybody going back from KubeCon, you have 50 minutes listening to our wonderful voices and thinking about security. Please like, share, subscribe, tell your friends, and leave us some questions. And with that, Zach, thank you. It was a blast.
A pleasure as always. Thank you, Ollie.
Bye-bye.